Digging through the past is not that hard. Rusted cars and broken shards. Mining memories in an old wrecking yard. Echoes of laughter.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire, and y'all, presumably still y'all, all are welcome in the Church of Internal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. And it's shooting during the day again. I got a gig Saturday night in Bastrop, Texas, and Friday night's when I like to record, but it's my kid's got a performance tonight, so I'm going to see that, going to see the kid rock out. And it is a balmy 70-something degrees in the shop, so it's about that time of year where everything in here starts smelling like fertilizer. Been kind of a boring week, kind of a laid-back week. Honestly, mostly just been doing yard work. You know, it's not super exciting. It's got to get done, though. But I am excited. We got a date locked down. Going mid-April. Go get mom's car. And bring it down here. Find out where we're going to go from there on that. You know. Man, I was writing this podcast and I was sitting down and going through these details and stuff in my head, and it kind of brought me down a little bit. I didn't mean for it to, but it was trying to write the ending. I had a hard time at the ending of this one. Glad y'all are here, though. Still don't have any sponsors, so I'm still going to advertise for people I love, of course. We got Rick's On-Site RV Wash, my cousin Rick Addy, up in the East Texas area. If you're in the 903 area code, he can probably take care of you. He does everything, mobile detailing, cars, boats. Mostly he started out with RVs, but cars, boats, whatever you got. Yeah, he might even come pressure wash your trailer house for you. I don't know. But I'll put his card up there. If you're in the area, you hit old Rick up. He's a good dude, man. He's a good hand, and does real fine work. Has real high attention to detail, and I've seen some of the RVs and the boats he's done, and they just look fantastic. So make sure you get that. Also, I've been talking to you guys a little bit about this charity that I want to be involved in, and I'm really excited about it. I was recently on an episode of the Diecast Breakdown podcast, which is a podcast all about diecast cars. We all know I'm a lover of anything automotive, especially little cars. Love being involved with the Hot Wheels people and that kind of stuff. So we've decided that the charity is called DrivenDreams.org, and one of the founders of the Diecast Breakdown podcast is who started this thing, and I actually pulled their website up so I could tell you a little bit about it if I can remember how my computer works. I can. DrivenDreams.org. They are trying to donate 20,000 diecast cars to kids in 2025. This year's Day of Giving will be Saturday, October 11th. 2025. You can make your donations before or after that, before or on that date. And you can go to their website and it tells you everything about it. I'm not asking you to send me stuff or anything like that. You can do this anywhere. I'm going to try to find some good locations in Houston. We've already started building our collection. I've been having my son pick out some cars at the grocery store that we're going to donate. So he picked this one out. It's a 76 Chevy Chevette. Looks like a little bit of a race car there. Very cool, set up like NHRA dragster. It's in the Compact King series, so that was the first one they got. And I'll start displaying them somewhere here as the collection grows. And we're going to try to raise as many cars as we can for these kids that just don't have a whole lot. The second one is the Alpha Pursuit vehicle. It's in the Hot Wheels First Response series. We got that one set up. Package got a little bent up. That's all right. We're not, these are not collectors. We're just trying to get some toys in the hands of some kids that might need some toys, you know. And I just think it's a fantastic thing, and it's right up my alley. But go check out their website, drivendreams.org. You can find out everything about it. If you decide that for whatever reason there's not a good place to donate to you or whatever, you want to send them my way so that we'll include them with the Wrecking Yard podcast donations, you're more than welcome to do that. Yeah, I mean, you can, anything you ever want to send to us here at the Wrecking Yard, you're welcome to do. And that is the Wrecking Yard Podcast, P.O. Box 131653, Houston, Texas, 77219. By all means. Whew, got a little coffee. Got me going. Boy, that brought. Anyways. I didn't select today's car because I have any great sort of affiliation to the car or anything like that. It was just really, it's really about a time period in my life that I've been just, as you get older, you think about these things, the stuff that you can remember. And this little minivan spoke out to me, man. It spoke out to me because the man that owned it and the time I spent in his tutelage. I wanted to read a little bit about it, and I'll just tell you right now, if you're my age and you worked on cars, you've probably done a cam seal job on a Mitsubishi 3-liter that was in these minivans. That's the most common thing I remember about them, is having those cam seals leaking on them. It was a pain in the butt. In the late 1970s, when Lee Iacocca went to Chrysler, you know, Lee Iacocca is one of my guys. He's a dude I'm a big fan of. I think the man was nothing short of genius. But one of the first projects he spearheaded was Chrysler had this idea for something they were calling the minivan. And it was, they wanted a van that would fit in a standard garage, but they wanted low floor height, kind of like a car, and they wanted car-like NVH levels, which is, you know, your noise, vibration, harshness levels. They're different for trucks and cars. Cars, of course, much quieter, less vibration. I mean, usually, depending on what car you buy. But that's what they wanted. In fact, they were going back and forth. They didn't know whether they were going to make it rear-wheel drive or front-wheel drive. And when Lee Iacocca come in, he said, no, let's make it front-wheel drive, because then we can just use the existing drivetrains from the Chrysler K cars, which were always already good sellers and fairly reliable, you know, as far as little front-wheel drive cars went. So that's what they did. They built this little minivan, and you've seen it under lots of names: Plymouth Voyager, Dodge Caravan, Chrysler Town and Country. The one I'm talking about today was Dodge Caravan. It's one of the best-selling minivans of all time. I think like 15 million of them sold worldwide. Yeah, I mean, the Honda Odyssey is the top seller, you know, in recent years, but the Dodge Caravan made its mark. Chrysler minivans made their mark. They were so common. I remember you used to be able to just go to Pick Apart and there'd be like six rows of them, you know. Those things were everywhere when I was growing up. And I don't even know how many I worked on, you know, over the years. Just buddies had them or whatever, but I remembered this one. come with a couple different engines. They come with a little 3-liter Mitsubishi V6. This is a second gen, so it come with a Mitsubishi 3-liter V6, which, you know, had the leaking cam seal problems. Also had a 2.5 4-cylinder, that Chrysler, little Chrysler 2.5 4-cylinder. It was pretty popular. They had that. You could actually get those minivans with a manual transmission in that 2.5 4-banger. And then they had a 3.3, and I think later on they put the 3.8, and that was a Chrysler V6. And the 3.3 was a fairly reliable little engine, but gave anything Harley-Davidson ever produced a run for their money as the oil leak king. You could tell one of them little minivans had one of the Chrysler V6s in it, because there's a puddle of oil on that 750 every time. This time in my life, it's about 1994, 1995, 93. It's from like 93 to 96. My parents had moved us into a neighborhood. We had previously lived in Mission Bend and A-Leaf, and they had moved us into a neighborhood in A-Leaf called Forest View. At the time, Forest View was just one little singular neighborhood all by itself, and it backed up to a neighborhood that was full of these patio homes. They were just brick home construction. They had the little brick walls around them. They didn't really have a garage so much as a carport. And they were all kind of connected all through that whole neighborhood, all the little brick walls connected to them. We lived on Tammany Lane in a little 3-bedroom house at the time. That neighborhood was right at the corner of Addicts Clothing and West Park Road. This before West Park Tollway was built, before there wasn't no highway out there. And then curling around the backside of that neighborhood was 1093, FM 1093, otherwise known as Westheimer. That neighborhood was kind of a weird place. There were some middle class people in the neighborhood, but it was mostly people like my parents who were making just enough money, paycheck to paycheck, to rent a house in a better neighborhood, but almost couldn't really afford to live there. Like, we didn't have nice stuff. My parents were struggling financially at the time, but they could afford to rent on that place. And it was a little better neighborhood than where we'd lived previously, where there had been a lot of violence, a lot of crime. And it had a little bit less of it, but it had a whole lot of us misfit kids, kids that didn't have the money for, you know, the clothes everybody else at school wore and stuff like that. And kids that were just kind of, our parents had made just enough money to move into this neighborhood, but, you know, we were just getting by. Our whole street, you know, mostly was folks just getting by. We were on the closest street to the outside of the neighborhood, the first street you came into, you know. Bray's Bayou won't run through that neighborhood, which is one of the many, many bayous, creeks, whatever you want to call them in Houston. Houston, they call them bayous. It was about maybe a mile or two from the West Oaks Mall. But back in West Oaks Mall was just this little mall on Highway 6 and Westheimer. And then all around it was just fields. It was just empty fields. Stuff. I mean, now it's all full of neighborhoods and apartment complexes and stuff. Back then it wasn't nothing. It was just empty fields. You know, and you just had West Park was just a little old road that run through there. Addicts Clothing was just a little old neighborhood road. And that part of Westheimer where it curled around Highway 6, really right after Westheimer passed Highway 6 is kind of where everybody just called it FM 1093 then. It was literally the end of Westheimer. Westheimer is like one of the longest streets in Houston. Runs all the way through Houston until it becomes Elgin. Westheimer was the main drag. That's where everybody took their hot rods and shit back in the day. In fact, right where that West Oaks Mall was, we used to ride our bicycles up there sometimes. And right to the side of West Oaks Mall, there was a strip center they had built, but nothing had ever been put in it. Just an empty strip center. And on Saturday and Friday nights, that's that parking lot would be full. Full of hot rods, old classics, Fox bodies and Camaros, hot rod trucks. Later on, when I got my first pickup, I was hanging out there too. But this is like those few years before you start driving, before you have your own vehicle, you know. In fact, I was kind of going through kind of a lonely time. I had had a best, after we moved to Houston, I became friends with this girl named Melissa. You've heard me talk about her. She was kind of my first love, puppy love type shit. And I had one other friend, and my one other friend was a guy named Randy. And me and Randy kind of belonged to the misfits. We didn't fit in, you know. We were just kind of poor little white kids that didn't really fit in anywhere. And we didn't fit in with the rocker kids, and we didn't fit in with the preppy kids. And we were just kind of the derelicts, you know, we were just kind of making our own way. And I wish I really remembered everything that happened, but something happened and me and Randy's friendship ended. And I was kind of lost after that because he was like my best bud. You know, we hung out together all the time, played together all the time. And he was going through a bunch of stuff at home. And whereas I stayed a misfit, Randy kind of became a bully. He was bigger than us and he started bullying kids. And you know, there's all manner of reasons why that could have happened. He was going through some shit at home. I know that. And I'm glad to say that, you know, 47 years of age, me and Randy are friends again. Randy is the guy that did my tattoo on my arm for my mother. Randy knew my mother. Randy, I mean, we would go to Lake Tyler. We, me and this dude hung out together all the time. And that friendship ended in an abrupt way, and I was watching him change and become this other person. I didn't know what to think about it. And then my parents moved us to this new neighborhood where I didn't really know a lot of people, you know? And the thing was, like, A-Leaf was kind of a weird place to grow up because there were these two high schools, and I've talked about this before, these two high schools that shared a campus. There was Elsick and Hastings, and when you were in eighth grade in junior high, it was a lottery to decide which school you went to, which high school you went to. And what happened is, like, all your friends and stuff, like, if they got sent to a different, you know, you just kind of grew apart. You kind of forgot about it. They went to Hastings, you went to Elsick. Or they went to Elsick, you went to Hastings, and you drifted apart. You found new friends in high school and that kind of stuff. And so I'd had, you know, all these little buddies and stuff that I run around with. And then there were some of them that lived in that neighborhood. My parents were really strict, though. Like, you know, they were still kind of in and out of the Pentecostal thing. And my mom was worried everybody I was running around with was going to get me in trouble. She didn't know I hadn't even met the real troublemakers yet. I had these little friends down at the end of the street named Justin. I used to hang out with Justin all the time. And then we got in trouble. There was a garage sale in the neighborhood, and we went to the garage sale. Me and some of these kids found a Laserdisc player and all the Laserdisc movies the guy had for them were porn flicks. disguised in regular laser disc packaging. And Justin went and got his saved up money, went and bought that laser disc player. We all set it up at Justin's house. We're watching porn movies when his mom came home, and we all got in trouble. And then, of course, my parents didn't want me hanging out with him no more. They thought he was a bad influence and all that kind of shit. You know, parents. I think oftentimes as parents, we find ourselves worrying about the wrong things. They didn't know the real problem was Melissa. I mean, my mom figured it out pretty early on, but they didn't know that she was the real bad influence. She was where I was getting into the real shit. But me and her we had an argument at this time over when all this stuff had happened, Randy, and we weren't really spending a lot of time around each other. But this is back in the early 90s, you know, there was no cell phones. There wasn't a whole lot of internet going on. You know, internet was a pain in the ass to get on. Trying to get on the internet was a task that required a lot of work and didn't yield much. Nobody knew what it was going to become yet, at least not us kids. Yeah, I told you, I was car crazy already, 14, 15. Posters of cars on my dresser door. But the best of days were spent riding bicycles at that time still. You know, it's your last years before everything gets super complicated. You're 14, 15. Those are the last years before things get really, really complicated. And I spent many an hour just on a bicycle, riding around the neighborhood, doing my thing, you know. Bicycle was freedom. It's like your first car. Your bicycle, it goes as far as your legs take it. Bicycle take me over to Melissa's house every once in a while. Bicycle take me anywhere I wanted to go. I guess I was probably about 15. I just got my... When I was growing up, when you're 15, you get your learner's permit. Your learner's permit meant you could drive, you know, with an adult in the car, a licensed adult in the car. I had my learner's permit already, and I would drive my mom around sometimes and sneak her car out over that old Oldsmobile Cutlass. I'd sneak that Cutlass Sierra out every once in a while and get in some trouble. Even though we lived at the edge of this huge city, this huge metroplex, it was kind of like being out in the country out there. It was just a little neighborhood out in the sticks. You know, it didn't feel like we were part of Houston. A-Leaf felt like its own little town back then, especially Mission Bend, that little area. It felt small. It did not feel like the big city. My mom was still terrified of it because it was bigger than anything she was used to, but felt small. We didn't feel like we lived in the city. We just felt like we lived in this neighborhood, you know. I mean, we used to ride our bicycles up and down West Park, you know, because it was just a little two-lane road and you didn't have to worry about anybody acting stupid on it most of the time. Right in the front of that neighborhood, right there off Addicts Clothing, right where Addicts Clothing and West Park met, there was a little stop and go. That was our little store. You know, we were kids, we'd go in there and buy our Bazooka Joe and our candy and all that stuff while we waited for the bus stop in the morning. And there was a little strip center attached to it, and my mom's friend owned that strip center. Her name was Marie, and she had a hairdresser place in that little strip center. And my mom worked up there as a nail technician doing nails and stuff for people. one day in one of those little empty strip center shops, a new shop opened up. It was called West Oaks Bicycle. In the early 90s, a lot of the BMX craze had died down. The big thing was mountain bike. Everybody was getting into mountain biking. There was magazines in the stores about mountain biking. And I had received a mountain bike for my birthday. It wasn't a high quality. It was a Walmart special, a Huffy. It was a blue mountain bike. In speed, and I had decided that I was going to be a great mountain biker. Aside from the fact I lived where there were no mountains in the swamp, but I had decided that was what my path was going to be. I loved that bicycle. I would get on that bicycle and go just as far as I could go. I spent a lot of time on that little Huffy mountain bike. And I was real excited to see that bicycle shop open up in that strip center. Not too long after it opened up, I had this friend Keith that I would hang out with every once in a while. Keith's the first guy ever, we smoked a pack of Marlboro Reds together one time that he stole from his mom. Boy, it made me sick as a dog. Keith had old, he was like me, he was a kid from, parents didn't have a lot of money. He had a Walmart bike too. And one day my mom's working up at the nail shop. We rode up there and we were going to go check out the new bicycle shop, man. I remember walking in that bicycle shop the first time. There's this little old bald man, probably in his 60s, early 60s. Had glasses, a bald head, hair on the side. You know, back when men didn't care about going bald, they just let whatever hair they had grow and they still got their normal haircut, or they all started shaving it off because of vanity and whatnot. Back when men would just be bald. He had on little bicycle, the little tight bicycle shorts, t-shirts at West Oaks Bicycle. How you boys doing? He welcomed us into the shop. Of course, we didn't have no money. Everything in that shop was expensive. I'd never been in a real bicycle shop. You know, to me, the bicycle shop was Walmart. I didn't know there was just a shop that all they had was bicycling stuff. He tolerated us kids, man. We'd come in there and hang out and look at stuff we couldn't afford, and he didn't care too much. He never minded that we came in there and hung out. He'd sit there and talk to us and tell us about the different kind of bicycles he had. He had nice bike. He carried, so back then, Bridgestone was a big bicycle builder. Bridgestone is a Japanese company that, of course, famous for their tires. But in the 80s into the early 90s, Bridgestone made some really high-end bicycles and people paid good money. Miss Jim was a serious cyclist, you know. He had one of them Ram Horn, you know, Quicksilver style bikes, and he put some miles on it, man. He rode, there was a bicycle group out of Katy he rode with all the time. He was in pretty great, you know, like outward physical shape. Miss Jim was healthier than most little old men I knew. He had some calves on him, you know. He was active. Rode that bicycle every day. And I would go up to that bicycle shop and hang out. That old man was probably tired of me hanging out. I don't know. I would go up there and hang out with him. And I kept thinking about this while I was writing. It was just a simple, time. We had these neighbors across the street, Mr. Willie and Miss Mary. Miss Mary was She was like a psychic, clairvoyant, older black lady. She made the best sweet potato pie I ever had in my life. And Mr. Willie was just always working on cars. He had an old Mercury Cougar that he was always out there tooling on. And he was always out there working on her car. And he was always in and out. Every time you saw Mr. Willie, he was in old work clothes and he was working on something. Mr. Willie had been a roofer, though. He had worked on there's a kind of a famous building in Houston. It looks like almost looks like a set of stairs on the top. Mr. Willie had worked on that roof. He showed me pictures. It was a small community. It was a small place inside of a very big place. A-Leaf was still a small place then. I think we spend a lot of time in our lives trying to get back to the small places that we come from. Because even if you grew up in a city or whatever, you probably grew up in a small place, a small community. And I think that's one of the things that's missing nowadays. I think with interconnectivity and everything is even though we're all more connected than we've ever been before, I think we're more alone than we've ever been before. It's hard to find those little small. It's why I make an effort to kind of talk to my neighbors and stuff. But my kids will never have that. Those small places. My oldest kid's got several good friends, but they all live in other places. They're connected through the internet. It's weird that we're as connected as we are today, and still so disconnected. And I don't know what the answers are for it. And I'm not one of these people, obviously hurt my income, but I'm not one of those people. Social media is awful. And others, it's not. It's nice to be connected to people. It's nice that I can still talk to people I grew up with and stuff like that. But there's something missing that was present at this time in my life. The owner, the guy that run the little stop and go, he was a little younger Persian dude. He had a hunchback. And he would talk to my father when my dad would stop there to get his Dr. Pepper in the morning. He would talk to my dad and tell my dad what I'd been up to, When I first started driving, I tried to Wahoo gas from that gas station one time. And he just immediately picked up the phone, called my father. My dad was waiting for me when I pulled in the driveway. We went back up there, paid for my gas, and I got grounded. I think I got my ass beat too. But my parents believed in grounding, but they also believed in ass whoopings, so they did both just to make sure. But my days were spent on this bicycle and in and out of the bayou. We'd go down the bayou and we'd catch turtles and catch frogs, look for snakes in the bayou. That's right, I forgot. So the lady ran the hairdressing place. She had a brother that worked there as a hairdresser. His name was Rocco. And Rocco looked like somebody out of a music video, man. Rocco was, he had long, curly, black hair like Slash, And a little mustache, a little beard. Women just loved him. He was very well built. Rocco had snakes. He had pet snake. He loved snakes. And we had figured out, us little neighborhood kids, especially me and my buddy Keith, is Rocco would pay us for snakes. If we went out and caught snakes, Rocco would buy them from us. Give us $5-$10 for a good snake. Especially if it was like a hog nose or something real cool. You could always catch him on the railroad tracks. Rocco would also, when we brought him little rats and mice that we caught, he would buy those from us and feed them to his snakes. He had a big old, one of those big old python, boa, whatever the shit. I don't know what they are. I'm not into snakes. But I was into snakes when there was a profit motive. I could catch some snakes when there was a profit motive back then. Me and Keith, I don't know how many snakes and rats and stuff we sold Rocco. But we would bring them up there in a bag, and Rocco had a little He'd go out in his car, had a little box, he'd put them in. And I went with him to his apartment one day, and it's just aquariums and snakes everywhere. It was crazy. I didn't like it. It wasn't for me. But Rocco paid good. And I kept, after I got my learner's permit, I kept going up to that shop. And I didn't really have a job yet. And the old man asked me, Jim one day asked me, I asked him for a job. He said, well, I can't really afford to hire anybody. He said, shop just doesn't make enough money for that. But he got, he got a little look on his face, and he's looking at that old beat up bicycle of mine. He said, but, he said, if you wanted to work in exchange for some parts for your bicycle, we'd fix that bicycle up. Well, that sounded like a deal made in heaven, you know, to a 15-year-old. What? Free parts for a bicycle? And I just hang out at the bicycle shop. And he worked on everybody's bicycle. He had the coolest, his little mechanic shop in this bike that he had it set up. He had every park tool known to man. That was like the baddest ass in bicycle tools back then. I mean, I don't know how many hours that man spent teaching me how to work on bicycles. Taught me how to break down cranks, clean them up, replace the bearings, repack cranks. Taught me how to take them chains apart, clean them, how to add and take links out of the chain. The biggest thing he had me do was true wheels. He had this little stand set up, a little indicator on it, and you mount the wheel on it, and you slowly spin that wheel, and you see where it pushes that indicator, and you take a little spoke wrench, and you tighten them spokes just a little bit, loosen them just a little bit till you got that wheel in true. That wheel will spin around, not moving that indicator too much. And that took a lot of time. Now, Mr. Jim, Jim was fast at it. Jim spin that wheel, look, watch it go around two or three times, stop it, make two or three adjustments. But, you know, as a kid with no patience and no experience, I would just sit there and work on them wheels forever. I think it was just busy work now that I'm older and know a little something about giving a kid a job. I think sometimes you just got to give them something to do. And, every day after school, I'd get on that bicycle, ride up there to gyms. True wheels for Jim in that shop. Hang out in the shop, true wheels for him. Mr. Jim, he would get up every morning about 5 or 6 in the morning. He'd get on his bicycle, ride 10 to 20 miles every day. That's what kind of health is. This old man was putting some miles on them bicycles. He'd get out there and get it every day. And all them people from the bicycle groups would come and bring him their bikes to work on. His daughter and son-in-law, I think they had just got married, and they were in there a lot. I would see them all the time, and they were in all the bicycling groups, and they would tell everybody about her dad's shop. Of course, he would go out there to the big meets and the rides. And he had this little beat-up gray 92 Dodge Caravan. Had 3.3 in it. Leaked oil like some 50. Had a little magnet on the side, said West Oaks Bicycle Shop. And after Miss Jim worked on their bicycle, he would put their bicycle in that van. He had little clamps and stuff back there to hold them, no back seats. And he would deliver their bicycle to people. It was a one-stop shop. Miss Jim would come out there, pick a bicycle up from you, take it to his shop, work on it. It was a different level of customer service, you know, than what's popular these days. I wish I knew how many hours I really spent truing wheels in that little shop for him. every once in a while at the end of the week, he said, man, let's put some new handle grips on that bike here. And he put some nice handle grips on it. Right across from that shop was my mountain where I practiced my mountain bike riding. So what had happened, there was a big old field. Now it's a neighborhood called Clayton Oaks, but back then it was just a big old field. And they had dug all the bayous for drainage for a neighborhood. But they hadn't attached them to Bray's Bayou yet. They had poured the concrete and everything. And so they were all over in this field. There was just these empty sections of neighborhood drainage bayou. Big, steep, you know, concrete culverts. And where they had dug all that dirt out to make those drainage, they had just piled it up in one big hill. And you drive down that Axcody and you can see that hill from a mile away. Big old hill. And the hill was just basically made out of loosely packed caliche and cracked clay. And so what happens every time it rained, that hill would get these little ravines and washouts in it. And we would take our mountain bikes up to the top of that hill and race them down that hill like we were the guys in the magazines, you know. And we'd hit them ravines and bend your wheels. And of course, I was on a cheap Walmart bike and I was constantly breaking it. I'd drag it over to Mr. Jim's shop and he'd teach me how to fix it. This is a time where my dad was traveling a lot. My dad was in Indonesia a lot. His job was changing. He would have to go to Indonesia for like 6 months at a time, doing consulting with Bekasi Metals in Jakarta. You know, he just wasn't there to teach me how to work on my bicycle. But Mr. Jim would fix mine. No matter how bad I broke that bike up, he'd have a solution. And because it was kind of a cheap, huffy bike, a lot of the good parts wouldn't fit it. But Mr. Jim would always figure out a way to make them fit using some parts off some other bikes. And after some time of being there at the shop, spending my days there after school at that shop, I didn't have a lot of friends. I had one or two little buddies, a couple guys we'd meet up there at the mountain to go ride. Go do our mountain biking. Every once in a while, some of the girls from the neighborhood would come over there and hang out, watch us jump our bikes and stuff. And there was a couple little smaller hills, and we had trails. And you get going fast enough off that big hill, if you didn't wreck coming down, you hit that next little hill, you get some pretty good air off of it. We thought we was jumping about 15 foot in air. It's probably about two, but we thought we was doing some shit, you know. And that's what I do, man. I'd go over there and work in his shop till he closed up. I'd go ride with my friends. If I broke my bike, I'd drag it home and I'd drag it back up to the shop the next day. Mr. Jim would teach me how to fix it. I spent a lot of time truing my own wheels because I was trying things on that bicycle. That bicycle wasn't made for it. It was just a cheap bike. It wasn't made for what I was putting it through. All right, one day... We had it set up where you could go down in that concrete culvert. It was double ended, had a smooth, like round finish on both ends, like a big, it was like a big oval. And you could do a couple laps around that thing up on the high side and build up some speed. And then you would crisscross down in the middle where there wasn't some trash and you could get through and come up on the other side, the high side, and turn back down and come back down through that bayou. And then at the top of that bayou, we'd set up a little wood ramp with some old wood planks and stuff. You hit that ramp, you could really get some air. You had to have that front tire up when you come off that ramp, land on that back tire. And then there was another little jump after that. You hit that jump. We'd spend hours down building up speed. Who could go the fastest? who get the most speed coming up and hit that ramp. I had a heavier bike. Some of my friends had better bikes than me. I had a heavier bike. I had to build up more speed. Hit that ramp. Hope nothing broke. Come up one day, I hit that ramp. Me and my buddy Keith was standing over here, and he was going to try to measure how high I jumped. I was having high jumps that day on that ramp. And I hit that ramp, and a ramp came apart. And when a ramp came apart, me and my bicycle went end over end and landed flat on the front wheel. And when I did, the front wheel just bent out from under me, and the handlebars, I forgot what you call that part that holds the handlebars and sticks down in the frame. Snapped. Hit me in the chest. I still got a scar from it. Big old cut in my chest. Knocked the wind out of me. The girls were watching that day. I mean, I was real embarrassed because the girls was watching. Bike was destroyed. At least I thought in my mind. I remember my friend Keith helped me pick up what was left of my bike and helped me drag it over there to the bicycle shop. And I just threw it in the trash behind the bicycle shop. It was like Mr. Miyagi type shit. I threw it in there. This guy, I guess he was my Mr. Miyagi a little bit. He didn't teach me any karate, which would have been really helpful in them days. But I remember I threw my bike in the trash can behind the shop. I was mad. And I went there. My mom was working as a nail person at the nail place, at the hair salon. I went there, and of course, I was bleeding and hurt. You always start crying when you see your mom and you're hurt. And of course, Marie let my mom take me home and doctor me up. I thought I'd killed myself. You know how you are when a kid. You think, it's ruined. I ain't never going to make it past this. I feel like I broke my leg and everything. Mostly embarrassed. When you get to the heart of the matter, it's mostly embarrassment. I got to stay home from school for a couple of days until I was feeling better. I got thinking about that bicycle, and I said, boy, I ought to go get that bicycle. And I walked up to the shop one day, and I looked in the trash can, the bicycle wasn't there. I then lost my bicycle, even though it was wrecked. I walked around the end of the strip center. I was going to go see my mom at work and then go to the little store and then walk back home. And I was walking by the bike store, and Mr. Jim saw me run up the door and tapped on the glass, told me to come inside. I came inside. He said, how are you? I heard you had a wreck. I said, yeah, I wrecked over there jumping my bike and ruined my bike and hurt myself. My leg still hurts. He said, come here, I got something to show you. And he took me back there, and he had put my bike back together. He had found a way to make another little shaft for it that would hold it, and he'd put me some newer handlebars on there, some more mountain bike, like real cool handlebars with my new hand grips I had gotten from him and my new brake levers. And he had put that bicycle, and he had brought that wheel back into true. I mean, that wheel was bent. And he had put the, it wasn't perfect, but it was, he put my bicycle back together for me. Wasn't no money in it for him. He just doing something nice for somebody. Wasn't too much longer after that. I got my license. And when I got my license, Miss Jim would, I was still riding my bike up there, and Miss Jim would he let me make deliveries for him in that little Dodge Caravan. He knew I had a driver's license, and he'd give me a little money to go deliver people's bicycles to him. I remember I found out that Dodge Caravan would power brake. You get a pretty good burnout out of that little Dodge Caravan. Boy, I thought I was hot shit. I dropped somebody's bike off one day, did a little burnout coming out of the neighborhood. I got back to the shop. Mr. Jim said, somebody called me and said somebody was hot riding my little minivan. He said, I couldn't figure out who that could be because you're the only person I let drive it. He said, just go easy on that old van. It's about to fall apart. He knew good well who'd been out there hot rodding his minivan. But he still let me make deliveries for him. You know, that goes with young people, man. I got car crazy. I got my first little pickup, that 72 Ford truck, and I stopped spending as much time at the bike shop. And girls became a bigger issue for me, and I started chasing girls and wanting to hang out with the hot rodders, and I didn't have as much time all of a sudden to go hang out at that little bicycle shop. And my mom didn't work at the nail place anymore. There was a new shop that had opened up in the strip center, and we hung out with that dude too. He had a RC helicopter shop. We couldn't afford none of that shit neither. I don't think anybody in our neighborhood could, but this guy had thousands of dollars RC helicopters. He had I remember that was like our first, as neighborhood kids, that was our first learning about like the internet and stuff, because this dude would get on IRC chats and AOL chat rooms and talk to people about RC helicopters. And he taught us how to do it. And he had a little nephew that he'd given a job at the shop who was about our age. Kind of a weird, quiet. He told a lot of big stories, this kid. And, like very obvious lies. But okay, kid, but one time this kid told us that he accidentally shot his best friend with a .22 and killed him when he was 14. And we just assumed it was another one of the kid's stories. We didn't believe it was real. And then one night, that kid was up there working at that helicopter shop, and law and 911, everybody got called up to the helicopter shop because that kid was sitting in a chat room telling people he was going to kill himself. And they come, and that kid ended up going to a mental health facility for a little while. And then his uncle like told us, like, no, he really did kill his best friend on accident playing with his dad's .22. When they were 14. So the kid was messed up. He went through some shit. We just thought he was making up a story. Kid told a lot of stories. We didn't know. But you know how it is. I mean, you get older, you just, I got into cars, man, and I wasn't spending as much time at that bicycle shop. And so I got that first truck. I mean, I was working on that truck all the time, my dad and stuff. My dad was home more. And sometimes toward the end of my junior year in high school, I went to stop by the bicycle shop, and I would still, every once in a while, I'd stop in there and show him something I did to my truck and talk to Jim and hang out with him a little bit, but not near as often as I had been. Not the hundreds of hours I had spent there. Anyways, one day I went to stop in that shop. I wanted to go see Jim. And the shop was closed. And I went home. I asked my mom about it. I said, did you know the bicycle shop's closed? I can't find Jim. And my mom said, Mr. Jim's sick. And he's real sick. Mr. Jim had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Now I got Mr. Jim's address. He lived behind us in the neighborhood behind us, and I went over there to visit Mr. Jim. His daughter was Mr. Jim was bad about eating stop and go hot dogs. He loved stop and go hot dogs. He'd go sneak him one every chance he got. And his daughter was like, Daddy, I don't want you eating that stuff. It's not good for you. It's not good for you. It's not good for you. She was always on him about eating them gas station hot dogs. And I remember I went to see him in his house that day, and he was on the bed and he was covered up, and he was smaller than he was. The cancer was eating him up. And I was a teenager, you know, I didn't really understand. He told me, he says, pray all them gas station hot dogs, they got me. My daughter was right. His wife is a sweet lady. They had been married for many, many years. And I asked him about the bicycle shop. Who's going to run the bicycle shop? Do you need me to go up there and work at the bicycle shop? He said, no, it's closed permanently. He said, I'm behind on rent. I'm being evicted. And I knew Miss Marie owned that store. Oh, I was mad at her. You know, I was a teenager. I didn't understand the intricacies and what it meant to have an empty shopkeeper in your shop. And I mean, she's going through her own stuff. You know, I know everybody loves to hate on landlords. It's not really my, I try to understand some of it, you know, and she'd invested a lot of money in buying the strip center. She needed businesses that could pay the rent in there. She was just doing what business owners have to do sometimes. But I took it very personally. I was so furious at her. I was so furious at her. He's sick, and then you just kicked him out on the street. And he's going to lose all his inventory, all his tools. Because my mind, people got sick and they got better, you know, at that stage of my life. At least that's what I thought, you know. I thought back then, like, all you really got to do is pray enough and you'll be okay. I figured back then I could just pray enough and Jim would get better and then he could reopen the bicycle store and everything in my little community would go back the way it was. The last time I rode that little old blue bike, this is a, kind of a messed up story too. Last time I rode that little blue bike, it was right before Jim got sick. I know that because Jim came and saw me in the hospital. I was riding that. It was one of the times when one of my cars was broke down or something. Me and Melissa had been spending a lot of time together, and she had this dude that was interested in her. That was kind of a derelict. He had a little 94 Chevy truck and thought he was hot shit. And he didn't like the fact I was spending all that time over there with Melissa. She was my best friend at the time. He didn't like that I was spending all that time with her. He was insanely jealous and said all kind of things about what he was going to do to me and this and that. I decided to ride that blue bicycle from my house. At the time, I was getting ready. It was my junior year of high school. I was really good at art. I was really good at drawing. and I was really wrapped up in drawing and art. And we had basically secured, I had gotten, I was going to go to Wharton. There was a little art school in Wharton, a little Wharton Community College had a real good art program. I was going to go to Wharton. That was my plan. I guess maybe it was my senior year when he got sick, because it was kind of at the very beginning of my senior year. Maybe that summer beforehand, but I was planning on going to art school. I used to be able to draw, like y'all wouldn't even believe if you see all some of my artwork when I was younger. I was pretty good. And I rode over to see my friend Steve. They had lived in those patio homes at the time, and I went over to his house. And I was riding home from his house, and I went to cross the street on my bicycle, and I heard an engine gun, and I looked and saw that dude Chevy truck. I wish I could remember that piece of shit's name. And he floored it and hit me on that bicycle. Bent that bike frame sideways. I had pieces of the grill of his truck stuck in my arm, and drove off and left me. And nobody could prove it, and you know, it was a different day. We, of course, told the cops all about him and everything. But I ended up going to the hospital, and it jacked up. My arm was in a sling for a long time. But I lost. I never got back to drawing after that. So I didn't end up going to the Wharton Art School. All that kind of went up in smoke. But I remember Mr. Jim come see me in the hospital right after that bicycle wreck happened. Check on me. He must have still had the bike shop open. It must have been right before he got sick. They never found that kid that run over me. He ran, shagged ass, never come back around. And some of the stuff gets washed by time. It's hard to remember exactly where it all goes, you know. But I wasn't too long after that Jim got sick. And I would go visit him from time to time. I saw him a couple times at his house. It was real early in my senior year, school year. Must have been September. Jim didn't get better. He didn't. He didn't get better. A lot of people get pancreatic cancer, don't get better. That's one that just it just destroys people. And Jim didn't get better. Jim that rode 20 miles every day on his bicycle didn't get better. And one day his wife called the house and let us know that Jim passed. I just got home from school. My mom told me, and I openly wept for that man. He was my friend. I remember being feel like, did I not pray enough? Did I not? You just believe when you come out of the kind of church I did, you believe certain things. And his wife asked if I would be a pallbearer for Jim. I'd never done that before. Didn't know I was about to spend a lot of that year being a pallbearer. And I've done it a lot of times since then for people I love. That was the first time I did it. And I remember very specifically, I remember going to be a pallbearer for him because my Papa Clark was visiting us in Houston at the time, and he had been in the hospital having a heart valve replacement. That's right around the time I've told y'all the story when he gave me the El Camino. when he was in the hospital at that time. That was after I'd already totaled my truck, lost my truck, and America's my. I didn't have a car at the time. My dad gave me a ride to the funeral. My dad took me to the funeral, and I was the only. Everybody else that were the pallbearers were his son-in-law and people from the bicycle club that knew him. And this 18-year-old that had never done this job before. And I was sad. Of course, I cried for him at the funeral and cried when I saw how small he was in his casket and how much he didn't look like a real person anymore. And I helped carry his coffin. I helped carry him to his place of rest. I remember that day, not just because of that. But we went back up to the hospital to see Papa Clark after the funeral, and I still had my dress clothes on. And sure, I probably still looked a little sad. And I was over there visiting with my papa, and I heard my dad talking to my mom behind me. They were kind of on the other side of the room. My mom said, "Howdy do?" And my dad said, "Oh, you know, you just start bawling." And I remember he said that about me, and it kind of triggered me. Like, that was my friend. I'm allowed to cry for my friend. And my Papa Clark must have noticed it. And my Papa Clark wasn't a soft, emotional man by any stretch of imagination. I've told y'all stories about him. But my Papa Clark put his hand, I mean, he reached out. He saw. He must have heard it and saw it because he reached out. He grabbed my hand. He said, "Babe boy, it's okay. Cry for people you love. Nothing wrong with that. Just don't look. Okay. That was your friend." I remember I started crying again then. I think that was like, you know, you have these different stages of your life where you lose faith in things. And I think I lost faith in some things that people got better and stuff right about that time. Because the doctor was telling us Papa Clark was going to be okay, but I wasn't sure anymore. It wasn't much longer after that. Papa gave me the El Camino. And about a month later, my meemaw was killed in a car accident, and I was a pallbearer for her at her funeral. And later on that February, Papa Clark died when his heart failed after he'd given me the El Camino. It's a weird time to think about. It's the last little piece of, last little piece of feeling like the world was okay, that the world could be okay, that things were always going to be okay. It's that time where you learn that that's not the truth. When you start losing people, and you realize that people just go away. You know, some people learn that earlier than others. Some people grow up without parents. I was fortunate not to grow up in that situation. I didn't lose my mother till I was a grown man. I don't know when it happens. I think about my friend David and his young daughters who've lost their mom at an age that I can't even comprehend. Like, they already know the world's not always okay. I did not know that until I was a teenager. You know, I was fortunate. I don't know what that time was for you, you know? Maybe you were a teenager. Maybe you were younger. Let's wrap it up there. Let's do some testimonials. some comments, some testimonials, if you will. Whew. Let me see, I got them right here. Do some comments from last week's show. What did we do last week? Oh, Pantera episode. Hell yeah. All right, here we go. Here we go. Contents from last week's show about the 72 De Tomaso Pantera. We got at Jake of all trades. Oh, Jake, master fun. What the F is Yacht Rock? Boy, I never thought I would have to explain Yacht Rock to somebody. That's a... Yacht Rock is like, it's like music from, it's kind of a broad category. The term only come around like early 2000s. There's even a documentary called Yacht Rockumentary or something like that. It's spelled doc, like boat doc. I looked up a definition for it because I was trying to explain it and I couldn't think of how to explain it. Yacht rock is a broad musical style and aesthetic commonly associated with soft rock that emerged in the late 1970s and early 1980s, characterized by smooth, high-quality production, breezy vocals, and catchy melodies, often invoking the image of a relaxing cruise. I went to Reddit to read about yacht rock, and there are great and varied debates about yacht rock. I read a 200 comment argument about whether or not Fleetwood Mac was rock, yacht rock. The old gatekeepers of yacht rock do not believe it is. I don't believe it is either. They want to know if Hall & Oates, there's a big debate about Hall & Oates, but that's more like that Philadelphia sound. That was a whole scene on its own. But the big purveyors of yacht rock, the ones that are the most common are Steely Dan, the Doobie Brothers, Toto, Kenny Loggins, Christopher Cross, and Michael McDonald. So that kind of music, you know. Rains in Africa, right? It's just a feeling. But just go search Yacht Rock on your music, whatever music app you use. Just search a Yacht Rock playlist. I guarantee you're probably going to love everything on it. But that's Yacht Rock. That was a really hard thing to define. Even after looking at the definition, I was like, how do I explain what the hell Yacht Rock is? At Mike Fleischer, old buddy Mike Fleischer. Bring down the Sherry K Absolute original as she drove. Then you can add a Scat 250 horsepower engine. Well, that's the thing, Mike. The Sherry K is not as she drove it. Me and my father robbed parts off that car for years. And there's just not all that's left is a shell. That's all I'm bringing down. In fact, I've been coming up with creative ways of how I'm going to move the shell around the yard. And I think for the meantime, I'm just going to have to build myself some kind of little platform with wheels on it. Used to roll it around to move it where I need to be. I've started creating a spot back here behind the garage for it. But I'm starting at nothing. I'm starting. All I've got is a shell that needs a lot of body work before we can even begin to think about what kind of drivetrain we're going to put in it. But on the opposite side of that coin of starting from nothing is the side of the coin that says this can be anything you want it to be. So, and y'all know I love to make fun of horrible automobile creations. I'm not about to be the owner of one. Because who knows what my crazy brain's going to cook up and do with this car. Let's see. At Dime 6-string 4510. Always loved the car, but I'm also a huge fan of the band Pantera. I've heard two different stories how the band got the name. One was someone was from a town called Pantego, Texas. I've never been to Texas, so I don't even know if the town is real, and I've never looked into it. I'm going to be honest with you, I haven't either. I don't know if that town exists or not. I know a lot of towns in Texas, never heard of Pantego, Texas. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Texas is a big place. The other was they named the band after the car. If that's the case, it's odd they never used any imagery of the car in their album art. I know it means panther in Latin-based languages, so maybe they just thought it sounded cool and both stories are bullshit. Well, I actually have some inside knowledge on that. So in my early years of doing comedy, going up to Dallas and doing comedy, Vinny from Pantera and his brother Dimebag were both huge, huge comedy fans. And they came to comedy shows all the time and hung out at the comedy clubs. And it was just not uncommon to see them. And I got to talk to Vinny Paul many, many times. And I know for a fact that they were in love with that car, and that's where the name of the band came from. I know that's what Vinny always said, was it was based, he just thought that was a cool name, and that's why he did it. Funny, I have another weird little connection to that band, too. I didn't know Dimebag, and I met him one time, but I wasn't into that. I like Pantera now that I'm older, but at the time, I wasn't into hard rock. I was a yacht rock guy. I was really into the headbanging. That wasn't my type of shit. But one of my childhood friends that I've known for many, many years is a guy named Marzi Montazeri. And if you're a hard rock fan, you probably know who he is. He played with Phil Anselmo. He was one of the Illegals, Phil Anselmo and the Illegals. And Marzi played with Super Joint Ritual back in the day. And Marzi and Dimebag Darrell were very, very close friends up until Dimebag's passing. Very, very close friends. There's hundreds of pictures of them together hanging out. And Marzi has had a wild and varied career as a heavy rock artist. And he's one of my really good friends. He's just another dude from A-Leaf I linked up with and became friends with as a young man. It's weird to have connection to a band that I wasn't into growing up. Kind of funny. All right, that's our testimonials. I got set. People pass, right? If you're here listening to this, you're definitely old enough probably to have lost some people in your life that meant something to you. I didn't start this out. I didn't mean for this episode to end up being so sad. I really just wanted to talk about all the stuff he taught me and the time he spent with me. Is every time I see one of those little Dodge Caravans, I think about Jim Miller. I love riding bikes, and up until 4 or 5 years ago, when my weight got so out of control, I rode bikes all the time. It was one of my favorite things to do. I've had a number of treks and different stuff. And once I got over 300 pounds, I stopped riding my bike. I'm very, very close to being at a weight where I feel comfortable riding my bike again. And I've recently pulled my bike out and started working on it and thought about Jim Miller the whole time while I trued up the wheel and checked the spokes and took the crank apart, cleaned the crank up, took the chain off and cleaned the chain up and started getting my bike ready because I'm very close to being a weight. I feel comfortable getting back on my bike, putting some miles on my bicycle every day. I think about, I told you all the story last week at the Planet Fitness, and I think about this all the time. Is something my papa used to tell me all the time. Saying, none of us getting out of this alive. And neither did Jim, you know. Something gets us all eventually. And you'll hear some people make the excuse, I'm not going to waste all my time. It's genetics. I'm not going to waste all my time exercising, doing these things. I just want my quality of life back. That's why I exercise, why I'm trying to work on my health. And I want to be around as long as I can, you know. That's not to say I might get on this bicycle and get hit by a bus, you know. It's not to say that my genetics might turn on me and I might end up with some disease or something that gets me, you know. You can't do anything about that. It's not to say I might not just have a heart attack at the Planet Fitness one day. There's not much you can do about that. But I intend on trying to get my health in a position that I can do the things I want to do again, like ride my bicycle. Like run around the yard with my kids like I used to. We used to do this thing at night called moon races where we'd go out when the moon was up and race back and forth across the yard. I missed that. I've got to get myself back to that place. What made me sad when I was writing this episode was I knew Jim was a military veteran. I couldn't remember what branch of the military he served in. And I went to researching, and I couldn't find any evidence that Jim existed other than my own memories. For all the internet offers, everything's hidden behind a paywall. I couldn't even find his obituary. I know he died in 1995. In the fall of 1995, I know he was buried at Forest Park Cemetery over on Westheimer. But I couldn't find any evidence of that. Couldn't find any evidence of his bicycle shop ever existing. Couldn't find anything other than the memories I have. I think I've about decided that sometime this week I'm going to drive over A-Leaf. I'm going to walk around Forest Park Cemetery until I find his headstone, because I know he exists. I know he exists. I know, you know, you have things like that from your past that there's nobody else left around to ask. That you're like, I know this thing happened. I know I was here for it. And sometimes when people get into all these metaphysical concepts about time being a circle and all this stuff, it's nice sometimes to have the people from your past, because they're the only ones that can prove to you some of this stuff was real. But I know it was real. I know how to work on a bicycle because this man taught me. I've said that before. The most valuable thing that we have to give is our time. That's the most valuable thing you ever have to give me. Y'all give it to me when you watch this show. It's a valuable gift. I give it in turn to you when I write and I research and I put things together and I make these. It's an exchange. The most valuable thing you can give anybody is your time. And that old man gave me his time. He gave me a lot of his time towards the end of his journey. I hope I helped carry him to his final resting place. I physically helped carry his body to his final resting place. And there's no singular piece of wisdom that I can tie all this together with and be like, oh, this one time Jim told me this. I don't have anything like that. There's no singular piece of wisdom that he gave me, just his time. But it has to have value, right? It must be valuable because it's still on my mind 30 years later. That has value. I don't know what that value is. That's what made me sad, was not being able to find any evidence that this man existed. Not being able to find any evidence that this bicycle shop I spent all my time in existed. Not being able to find any evidence that this time happened on paper other than my memories. The man was a military veteran. And if he gave me that time, I'm sure he gave somebody else some time. I'm sure he gave his daughter his time. I know he gave his wife his time. I don't think she lived much longer than him. I know she moved out to Arizona. And she got an RV, and that's the last I ever heard. I hope, and I think it's something we can all, especially if you're entering midlife like me, that there's somebody out there that I gave my time, that 30 years from now will be thinking about me because of the time I gave them when I'm gone, when I'm no longer here. I hope that there's people that I have given my time. I hope that I continue to give my time to people I care about, so that there's people that remember when there's just no evidence that I existed except their memories. It has to have value. It altered who I was. It has to have value. I can't distill it down to one thing that he taught me, but taught me. He gave me his time. I think I need to be more mindful in the future to make sure that I'm giving my time to the people that need it. And maybe something we can all work on together. I don't know. Maybe you're already doing it. I know quite a few of you are mechanics, and you give your time teaching other people how to do things. I think it's very valuable. I think if you're worried that you don't have any value, you shouldn't be, because if you're giving your time, some snot-nosed teenager is going to be thinking about you 30 years later while he changes the chain on his damn bicycle. Love you guys. I'm rooting for you. I tell you that every week. 100% mean it. Men like Jim is the reason I mean the things I say. I mean it 100%. I'm rooting for you guys. There's room at the table for all of us. Hope you're getting by the obstacles in your life. Hope you find somewhere to effectively give your time. I hope you're sharing your time with people who will think about it for a very long time. I'm JW, and I love you.